Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Good morning, everyone. We've got a lot of people in the room. We've got a lot of business to do. A quorum is present. And first order of business is to approve the minutes from March 1st. Representative Bierman.
I move to approve the minutes of March 1st, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay, the first bill on the agenda is House File 2286. Chair Noor is here to present the bill. I will move that House File 2286 be, what are we doing, laying it over? Oh, we're moving it to Ways and Means. That's what we're doing. Okay, be moved to, re-referred to Committee on Ways and Means. Right, thank you. Oh, right. Okay. And then there is an author's amendment, which I think, Chair Noor, you wanted to adopt before we discuss the bill. Am I right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, so I will move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. So, Chair Noor, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Congress passed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, FFCRA.
And Chair Noor, one thing about this weird room, the mics aren't very good, so if you could pull it really close, it would be great.
I can hit the mic, Madam Chair.
That's much better. Thank you.
So at the beginning of the pandemic, under the FFCRA, which included requirements for Medicaid programs, that we keep people who are enrolled continuously until the end of the public health emergency. With that, we received additional FMAP, which is the federal medical assistance percentage, by 6.2%. It was close to $2 billion that the state of Minnesota received. That tied the continuous eligibility for individuals to the public health emergency. With that, Madam Chair, we received a public health emergency continuous for 11 times. That meant that we continued to include individuals in the Medicaid program for all that time until last year, when the Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2022 was signed by President Biden during December 29th, that delinked Medicaid continuous eligibility from the public health emergency. Members, that means that 1.5 million Minnesotans will now have to undergo renewal or redetermination for their Medicaid eligibility and Minnesota care. That means one in four Minnesotans will have to go through that process. This is unprecedented. This is a significant issue we're facing today as we think about medical eligibility for folks. The numbers, based on what we have, 40% of those who are in Medicaid are kids, their children. What this bill does is get us ready, because the federal change requires us to start beginning renewal effective April 1, 2023, just a month away, or a few weeks away from now. Many of your constituents will receive their letter about renewal process. We haven't done this for more than 3 years. The counties have not touched those cases for 3 years. The number of enrolled individuals increased from 1.2 to 1.5 million individuals, almost by 300,000. And guess what? With this renewal, the unwinding of continuous eligibility, more than 200 Minnesotans are projected to lose their coverage. I don't think any one of us here wants to see kids lose their coverage. I don't think anyone in here wants to see individuals with disability, elderly, and those who are in need lose their coverage. This is a call to action, members, that we provide an opportunity for the department to start the unwinding. So in this bill, we're ensuring that we provide resources to the department. We're also including continuous eligibility coverage for kids up to age 19 for 12 months. Minnesota is one of the few states that does not provide continuous eligibility for 12 months. It's something that we call Medicaid CHAN, meaning that someone who's eligible today because of their income, circumstance, household will change. Guess what? They're eligible today, they're ineligible tomorrow, they come back after 2 months, and then they get back into the system. So in order to provide that safety net for kids, the federal government under the CA Act of 2022 requires us to implement continuous coverage for kids effective January 1, 2024. With this bill, we're saying that we should request the change for the state plan, which we can request so that we can start implementing the continuous coverage for kids up to age 19. Within this bill, we're also requesting 1115 waiver so that we can cover kids up to age 6, let alone 12 months. We know things change. We want to make sure that every kid gets their best health coverage that we can give to them. So we can do that today and ask for that waiver in this bill as we have written. Madam Chair and members, we understand that the navigators are key to ensuring that we provide help to those individuals who need help across the state. We're increasing their rate to up to $100 for the application processing, including the grants for them to do the work that is necessary to be done immediately. We're also providing funding for the county. I used to be an eligibility worker. Healthcare is complex and complicated. We're providing an opportunity for the department to disregard assets. We know many seniors have accumulated assets. We're giving them up to a year so that their assets do not exclude them. Members, the asset limit for elderly and disabled is only $3,000 per individual. For the last 3 years, I'm sure many people received that. So guess what? If a senior member is ineligible because of their asset limit, they may end up being in a nursing home and they cannot disenroll them because the law requires that they stay in there. Can you imagine someone who didn't know that their eligibility ended? That cost stays with the hospitals and other entities who do not have the funding. We also pushing out the premium pay for Minnesota Care because we stopped collecting the premiums, so they're able to continue their coverage until their renewal. We're also giving flexibility to the commissioner because we know that the CMS, the federal CMS guidance keeps on changing. With this process, they will be able to continue providing changes as required. Members, we are also changing how verifications are used. Within this bill, we are funding the work number, which the counties can start looking into income and employment verification for individuals who are being redetermined. We're going to be doing determination for up to 60,000 effective May. The first letter goes out this month, and I believe next month when the applications are sent. It's in paper. Every renewal that will be sent out is going to be in paper format. There's no email, there's no text, there's nothing online. It has to be submitted in paper. Once we receive it, you have to start determination, income, assets, everything. With that complexity, we know that the counties also need that help. The workers haven't touched cases, they're new to the process. The complexity of the process requires us to act today. And with that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask the fiscal staff, Mr. Berg, to go over the fiscal part of this bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Neuer. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Doug Berg from the House Fiscal Staff. I believe in your packet you should have a one-page spreadsheet titled House File 2286, Public Health Emergency Unwind. That spreadsheet represents the bill as it stands with the author's amendment on it. And just quickly to orient you, the middle three columns are fiscal years 24 and 25, and the right-hand columns are the tails. There are, I will mention sort of a few buckets that this falls into. Line one is a governor's initiative that Chairman Noor referred to. It's a contract for a third-party service, the work number, that provides income and asset verification services. So the cost here is for a professional technical contract to provide those services. Line two is an increase to navigator reimbursement from the current $70 per incident or case to $100. Lines three through nine are the governor's initiative that Chairman Noor mentioned for continuous eligibility. And then lines 10 through 17 are the governor's initiative for responding to COVID-19. This is the actual core of the unwinding, the redetermination of every case over the next 14 months. And then lines 18 is the elimination of premiums in MinCare that Chairman Noor mentioned. And 19 has the systems costs to go with that, the administrative costs. Line 20 includes grants to counties to assist them with the PHE. That's $36 million to the counties to help them navigate the unwind. And then line 21 has got staffing to administer that grant. Line 22 is outreach, $5 million at the department to do outreach to inform people that they need to get redetermined and that they may be eligible for other programs and such. And the staffing for that on line 23. And then lines 24 through 28 are the federal funds participation offset we have in several cases that are listed there that reduce the cost. So in total, on line 29, this bill with the amendment costs $101.9 million in 24-25 and almost $103 million in 26-27. I will note, since there was discussion in the Human Services Finance Committee and the numbers, the totals are lower than they were, it's because at that point there was an item in there to reduce cost sharing in Minnesota Care. The amendment takes that out of the bill, which is why the numbers are lower than they were in total. And Madam Chair, that's kind of the summary. I can answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Berg. So I think we should probably go to testifiers. And so on the list here, I have Chelsea Olson from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. If you would come down, and then Matt Freeman, please be ready to be on deck. So welcome to the committee. And 2 minutes, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association representing the nonprofit health insurance plans in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Hennepin Health, Medica, Sanford Health Plan, and UCare. 84% of Minnesota's public program enrollees are served by council member plans. As such, we understand the challenges of resuming eligibility checks after a three-year pause and the significant impact redeterminations will have on plan enrollees. To support Minnesotans during this process, the council plans have been meeting and working collaboratively with DHS, MNSHR, county and tribal agencies, as well as other stakeholders for nearly 2 years now to help plan for the end of the continuous coverage mandate. Our shared goal is that no one faces an avoidable gap in coverage and that Minnesotans continue to have access to affordable and timely care. We support the provisions included here in Representative Noor's bill. The inclusion of dedicated funding for counties, navigators, and agencies, including IT upgrades, is an essential element to help make the enrollment process as simple and efficient as possible for enrollees. Additionally, we support the continuous coverage provisions that will help reduce administrative churn and ensure that children have consistent access to health care. Importantly, while 4 in 10 Minnesota kids are Medicaid, 64% of Black Minnesota children are served by Minnesota healthcare programs. So from a health equity perspective, we know that these policy changes will be especially impactful for communities of color. We urge members to support this bill, and we urge members to expedite its passage to ensure that the additional resources will have the maximum impact possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Freeman, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, which represents all 87 counties' human service directors, and a human service policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, representing county commissioners across our state. And just want to briefly testify in support today of the provisions in this bill. We know that medical assistance and Minnesota care cover the most vulnerable populations here in Minnesota, and it's the counties who process most applications for medical assistance. Counties will be facing a vastly increased administrative burden during the COVID unwind process, as we see increased enrollments of over 30%. And so I want to thank Chair Noor for this bill and for resources to help support counties in the process of ensuring we don't have unnecessary churn and those who are eligible remain enrolled in these programs. In addition, I want to support the amendment that Chair Noor has brought forward to include sufficient resources for the employment and income verification for public assistance programs line. That is a resource that counties use for employment verification that is much more efficient and accurate, and appreciate that being fully funded by the state as well. So happy to stand to additional questions on county impact or costs, and thank you for your time.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the public who wants to testify on the bill before we go to questions? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead, and 2 minutes or less, please.
Stephanie Radke, President, Portico Health Net. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I would just like to very briefly share my support for Chair Noor in moving this bill quickly and including both one-time and permanent incentive funding increases for Navigator organizations. This bill and this funding is critical for Navigator organizations across the state to be able to do this work and work with our communities over the next 14 months in the unwinding and going forward. And I am here on behalf of 21 Navigator organizations across the state, and there is a letter included in your packet. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions related to the Navigator role in the unwinding.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right, I'm not seeing anyone, so we can go to member questions and discussion. Representative New Brindley, and then Elkins, and then Nadeau.
Thank you, Matt. Is this microphone working this time? No.
Sorry. You will, of course you can hear me. I know I got to switch this up. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Noor. I'm wondering if Mr. Freeman from the counties would be willing to stand for a question.
All right. Go ahead and start with your question, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. I appreciate your testimony in the bill, and it's really good to hear from the counties. That's been my primary concern throughout this, because, frankly, the counties do the bulk of the work for these re-enrollments. And so my question is, you know, as you have looked at the situation with your counties, is that $36 million going to be sufficient to meet the needs at the county level?
Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative New Brindley. Really appreciate the question. When we started conversations about what additional resources counties do need at the local level, we did a methodology of reaching out to a number of counties, both evaluating what their need is, how they would be able to spend the resources in this tight timeline, and put it to good use with integrity. And so that $36 million number is a number that we corroborated between Blue Earth County, Hennepin County, Pine County, Morrison County, a wide variety of counties, to verify what they're able to spend. Again, some of the system improvements, technology improvements, and those go beyond what that $36 million. And so we'd love to have more advanced infrastructure to help us in this challenging time. But we do think that $36 million number is appropriate, that we'll be able to use it effectively and with integrity.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. That's really helpful to know and to hear of the variety of counties you worked with to ensure that you'd have the resources you need. And frankly, I agree, and I think particularly with such a significant surplus of money that can only be spent one time, it is a really good opportunity to upgrade systems. And this has been a problem in the human services world certainly for as long as I've been around. I have one more question for Representative Knorr, and this is just making sure I understand the language. And Chair Knorr, am I understanding this correctly? So I'm looking at the amendment, and in subdivision 7, paragraph D, is that the funding for that additional $30 in Navigator payments?
And could you give us a line number, Representative Brindley?
Yes, 3.1.
Thank you.
To 3.4.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is the additional funding for the increase from 70 to 100 hour Navigator Assistant Program. Thanks, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we doing this on paper because of some federal requirement that it be done on paper, or state requirement that it be done on paper, or just because we don't have the capability to do it any other way?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you ask me, I'll go online, but I just wanted the department to quickly respond on that. I know there's been a major challenge. Someone is coming quickly, and I think there's a federal requirement for some of that process, but I'll let the department respond to that.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name for the record and go ahead and answer the question.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Anna Ashby with the Department of Human Services. Representative Elkins, it's actually due to our systems limitations. So as you have likely heard, our eligibility systems are very challenging and expensive and take a long time to fix and sort of respond to different changes, and unfortunately a large number of our eligibility determination paperwork is still done just like that through paper instead of through our systems.
Representative Elkins. Okay.
Speechless.
Okay. I know what you mean. All right. Let's go to Representative.
I'll be able to retain my composure here shortly. So second question is, well, now I did lose my train of thought. What information is required to assess eligibility under this unwinding?
Okay, and if we could, that's probably a bigger question and maybe even the topic for a whole hearing, but yeah. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the unwinding process, we'll look at the income for individuals because it's income-based for all the programs. But also for elder and disabled, we look at their assets, that means securities, whatever assets that they have, including bank accounts and many other verifications. So it's complicated when it comes to doing the spend down. If anyone has never done that, it's really one of the most complex way of making people eligible for Medicaid going through that process.
Yeah, so okay, Madam Chair, just
really
real
short,
quick,
one more
real
follow-up. One.
So where do you go for the income information? So I understand that there's like a federal hub that just basically has income tax filing information. And is that the primary source that you're still going to? So you'll only be looking at the last available income tax return.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It depends. You know, most of the income verification is done by the individual by providing their pay stubs, tax returns, whatever they can do, because they're different groups. There's folks who are self-employed. But we also use the periodic processing to collect that data and figure out the income. If there's any additional information, I'll let the department do that. But I think basically it's more of what the individual provides and then cross-checking with what we have in the system.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. All right. Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two, I think, clarifying questions, and thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you for including the money for counties. It's so vital. I mean, that is heavy lifting. My first question, and I'm going to put them all together, and then you can take them however you want, has to do with the new contract on line one of the spreadsheet, the $2.345 million. Is that an adequate amount that will cover the cost? And if it's not, will counties be on the hook for any additional costs associated with that? That's number one. And number two, can you just talk a little bit about the $5 million in outreach grants? It seems like a significant amount. I mean, when we look at, you know, buying down the cost of premiums from InCare, which is awesome. You know, we're basically spending an equal amount on outreach, and I'm just curious how that amount came to be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Chair Nora.
Madam Chair, just to start with the work number for income verification, with the amendment, we are fully paying, so the counties are off the hook on that portion of it. The second question about the $5 million outreach, we're talking about 1.5 million Minnesotans. That means every corner of the state. We have to reach them where they are. We have to meet people where they are, and get that $5 million may not even be enough. Like I stated, you know, we've been receiving the enhanced FMAP. By the end of this year, that number goes from 5% in the next quarter to 2.5 to 1.5. We have the resources from the federal government to do this. In fact, you cannot find someone because of whereabouts unknown, you have to do your due diligence. So that requires us to reach out in places that we have never done before to make sure that we don't exclude anyone in the system. For us to do that, I think the $5 million is not even adequate to do that work by itself.
All right. Representative Nadeau?
Just to follow up. And thank you for that. And I don't mean to be argumentative. I don't want you to be defensive at all. But we've got navigator grants of $10 million. We've got another $1.5 million, $1.47 million for increasing that cost. This is a population, and I understand, yes, there are some we don't know where they are. The vast majority of this population, we know where they are. We serve them. We serve them at the county level. And that was the only reason I brought it up. You don't need to respond. I just thought it was an interesting number. That's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, members. And I don't have anyone else on the list, so I just would like to comment, first of all, to thank Chair Noor for carrying this, because this is a very, very important thing that we're doing this year. I hope you all understood that from his comments. It's really critical. The second thing I just want to make sure everyone understands is we're moving this bill early because of the urgency of having these resources. This is not the entire budget for this committee by any means, and if, for example, that $5 million would prove to be not enough, we may get some adjustment that comes forward from the agency to tell us that we need to do something in addition, or, you know, so this isn't sort of the last word on what the dollar amounts might be, but the agency does need this early, and the counties need it early, and we need to get this in process. So that's why we're hearing this separately. We're moving it to Ways and Means. Our intention is to hear it on the floor soon so that we can start to get some of these dollars out the door. But yes, you know, I certainly hope that our budget target will be bigger than this. I don't know that for sure. The speaker has not given me a target yet, but I fully expect that this will not be the whole thing. But this is within the jurisdiction of our committee, actually, notwithstanding that Chair Noor is carrying it, and he is just doing a tremendous service to all of us, to this legislature, and to all of these people who are depending on this coverage, and to everyone, and especially to me, by carrying this bill. So I really do want to thank you for that, Chair Noor. So, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2286, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you so much. All right, the next bill on our agenda is House File 17, Chair Stevenson. And This does. Yes, there's an author's amendment. Okay. Yes. Right. Is Chair Stevenson here? I don't see Chair Stevenson in the room. So, okay. So while we, okay. So while we are waiting for Chair Stevenson, I think we can go ahead and take up House File 2621, which is Lead Schumacher. And just to orient members as we take up House File 2621, so I think, Chair Schumacher, your motion would be to lay this over for possible inclusion, correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I think the bill is actually in the Commerce Committee, so this will just be informational from what I understand.
Oh, okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. So we're just taking it up informationally. And just so members understand, so our intention, this was one of the Department of Health bills, and so today we're assembling our policy omnibus with mostly bills from the Department of Health. So our intention is to give this an informational hearing and then add it to our omnibus with an amendment. So Representative Schumacher, please go ahead and tell us what you would like to about the bill, and feel free to phone a friend, since this is an agency bill, if you care to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, the department might as well start coming down for this. But basically, since 1993, the Department of Health has required, or legislation has required, that any hospital expansion projects or projects of any sorts that they have, that there's a review process from the Department of Health. And currently, the Department of Health has to respond to each of those review processes, whether they're deemed appropriate or inappropriate. And this bill just changes that so that the Department of Health does not have to report back to the hospital if it is deemed appropriate. So they're only having to recognize those or alert those who are deemed inappropriate, which, as I understand, is a very, very limited number of expenditures.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Lead Schumacher. And Mr. Gildemeister, did you want to come and say anything in addition? Or I see people are scrambling, probably because we pulled this bill out of order, but if you can add anything.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health, and it's our team that takes in capital expenditure commitments, reporting on capital expenditure commitments from the healthcare system. There's a cap on them, so only sizable commitments are being reported. And I can't remember the last time we found a capital expenditure commitment in our retrospective review not appropriate. So the effort to sending out more than 100 of notices to providers that their review, that their commitment from years back is not, it was appropriate or was not appropriate. It's just a lot of bureaucracy, and we'd like to save ourselves that work. There's no appropriation for this initiative, and also provide us the paperwork.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Are there any questions, discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, and this is to the testifier. If in your memory there hasn't been one that's not that hasn't been appropriate, and now we're only going to respond to the ones that are, and you say there's hundreds of them that are submitted a year, I mean, are we at the point where maybe we should relieve the providers from having to make this report?
So I don't know, Mr. Gildemeister, I don't know if you want to. That's more of a policy question, I think, but please, if you want to, respond.
Madam Chair, Representative, I was just going to say that. It's a policy question. I think what the reporting provides the legislature and the public and premium payers and others is sort of a eyeballs into the investments in the healthcare system, which, of course, drive ultimately healthcare spending and premiums. So we pay for them whether they are, however they are funded ultimately. And I'm happy to share some data with the committee if that's helpful to give you a sense sort of which institutions, by what volume, and for which kind of investments these capital investments have been made. Perhaps that's helpful.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. So I think the answer is that that might be another bill for another day, Representative Nadeau, certainly something worth thinking about. But I don't, you know, today this is more or less just a technical bill is kind of how I see it, and one that, you know, reduces bureaucracy, as Mr. Gildemeister said, a little bit. So with that, I think we're not laying it over because it's just informational at this point. But thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for dropping that bill for the department. So I saw that Chair Stevenson is here, so I think we can move to House File 17. And so welcome to the committee, and the chair will move that House File 17 be laid over for possible inclusion, the third engrossment. And there is an author's amendment that I think Chair Stevenson, the A9, I think, was your amendment. And did you want to put that on the bill right now before we start to discuss it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So I will move the A9 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the chair wants to have it, with the Chair Stevenson wants to have it discussed. So all in favor of adoption of the A9, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 17 is an effort to take serious action to confront the crisis pertaining to the ever-increasing, exorbitantly high cost of prescription drugs. I think that probably every member sitting around the table today can think of multiple conversations with constituents who are making extremely difficult decisions about their medication. Do I pay the rent or do I pay for my prescription drug? Do I buy groceries or do I buy my prescription drugs? How much can I ration my prescription drugs and still live? These are questions that Minnesotans are asking every day all across the state. They are unconscionable questions that no one should be asking in Minnesota in 2023. The bill attempts to tackle the problem of the high cost of prescription drugs through two mechanisms. First, it gives increased powers to our Attorney General to go after price gouging by prescription drugs in the generic marketplace in particular. Frequent question is why just generics? This bill, members who have been around for several sessions might recall a version of this bill from years ago that also included brand name drugs. We've narrowed it down to generics because of some unfortunate case law coming out of the federal circuit saying that we are preempted from doing this kind of legislation with regard to drugs that are still under patent. I'm here to tell you that while we often think of generics as the low-cost alternative, and that's often the case, there are also examples of price gouging behavior in the generic marketplace. And so this is, while not all that I would hope that we could do on price gouging, is something that we should do. The other half of the bill creates a prescription drug affordability board. And we have Chair Akam here of the Energy Committee, and I think there are a few other members who sit on the Energy Committee, and they are familiar with the Public Utilities Commission, which stands between consumers in Minnesota and the monopolistic power of our utilities and protects consumers from unchecked monopolies in the utility sector. And just like that protection is critically important, we need something to stand between the consumer and the monopolistic power of large pharmaceutical companies who are selling drugs that people need to live. And that's what the PDAB would do. So, Madam Chair, that's kind of a 10,000-foot overview. I know, I'm sure there are people who want to testify on this bill, and so maybe I'll leave it there and be happy to answer questions at the appropriate time.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So I think what we will do is we have a number of testifiers. We also have some amendments. So I think we'll hear from the testifiers first, and then we'll take up the amendments. So first on my list, I have Robert Hader, and then Don Bernfinn. And I have to ask everyone to please keep their testimony to 2 minutes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Hyder, and I am the legislative director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a statewide multiracial people's organization with about 15 years of experience in healthcare policy, from Medicaid expansion to prescription drug costs. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 17 and provide some context as to why this bill is so critical. First, federal actions on prescription drug costs are few and far between. Medicare Part D was established nearly 20 years ago, and the drug cost provisions in the recently passed IRA will only lower costs on some medicines for some Medicare patients at some point in the next 5 years. When it comes to key healthcare policy, states have always been doing the heavy lifting, the lifting that makes action by the federal government possible. Child-only healthcare coverage, expansion of affordable healthcare, and more recently, pharmacy anti-gag rules and drug price transparency leadership all came from the states and inspired the federal government. We have all paid the price for decades of inaction on drug costs, which is why House File 17 is so important. A PDAB will lower drug costs for patients, providers, and payers. Minnesota is well positioned to establish an effective PDAB and learn from states that are currently in the process of implementing boards, despite industry efforts to stall. Lastly, we support House File 17 because our government has a responsibility to address the out-of-control prices of taxpayer-funded drugs. Nearly every medicine on the market today comes from decades of publicly funded research. Our tax dollars fund everything from research and development of treatments for rare diseases and the COVID-19 vaccines, which received over $18 billion in publicly funded R&D and manufacturing. Even with the degree to which we, the taxpayers, support R&D, we're still forced to pay high prices of prescription drugs in our public health care programs and at the pharmacy. At the same time, CEOs are legally permitted to price gouge life-saving medicine while spending tens of millions of dollars on lobbying, advertising, and stock buybacks.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Minnesotans deserve a better deal. Prescription drugs do not work if people can't afford them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Don Bernfinn? Welcome to the committee. If you would give us your name and your affiliation and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Don Bernfinn and I'm from Chisholm, Minnesota. I'm a member of SEIU and I've been a home care provider for over 30 years. And SEIU represents more than 40,000 members in the state of Minnesota, and we support House File 17. And my story today is about my daughter, Emily, and what happened to her a few years ago. She became very ill with an infection, was uninsured and couldn't go to the doctor, and wound up becoming even sicker. Went to the ER, where she was given her first dose of antibiotics and a prescription for generic drugs, and we went to the pharmacy. She could not afford the drugs. They were over $375. She and her boyfriend both worked, but their jobs paid little over minimum wage. I was not in a position to help her pay for those drugs, so she went without. She wound up back in the ER again, and this continued over the course of a year. And she could have lost the ability to have children. She could have died from this infection. The only thing about this that was good was the fact that she was unable to work and her income was low enough that she was able to get state Medicaid and was able to finally get the medication to get better. So this shouldn't be happening. So we ask that you support this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Bentley Graves. Followed by Noah Llewellyn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent more than 6,000 employers and 500,000 employees across the state of Minnesota in every industry, every corner of the state, every size of business. We work on healthcare issues because of the cost considerations for our members and their employees. Not surprisingly, then, there is, I think there's much agreement that you can find within the views of our members about the high cost of drugs and the pressure puts on their ability to offer benefits to their employees. However, we do have concerns about the approach of House File 17. You'll hear, I'm sure, in a minute, a number of concerns from the industry itself. We share a number of those concerns, but predominantly our concern is with the approach the bill takes in having a government appointed board setting prices for privately produced products in the private marketplace. And for our members as private businesses, that certainly sets a concerning precedent as we look to solve other problems that we might have as a state. So we've had a number of conversations about with us with Chair Stevenson, and certainly want to continue to work with him to find solutions to bring the cost down of health coverage for our members and for their employees, but do so in a way that doesn't bring with it some of the unintended consequences we think might come with it. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And before you leave the table, so does the chamber membership include any drug companies or PBMs?
Yeah, our membership includes, you know, businesses in basically every sector of the economy. So health industry is no exception.
Okay, so you do have drug companies and PBMs among your membership?
Yeah, we have okay. Hospitals, we have PBMs, we have pharma companies, we have insurance okay. Companies. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Madam
Just
Chair.
For context. Okay, Noah Llewellyn. Welcome to the committee. And next will be Sharon Lamberton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Noah Llewellyn. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office. Attorney General Ellison regrets that he can't be with you today, but it has asked me to testify in his stead to voice his strong support for HF 17, which takes important steps to combat the high cost Minnesotans pay for drug prices. In 2019, the Attorney General convened a bipartisan, expert-steered task force to study the problem of the high cost of prescription drugs and to make recommendations that tackle the problem. The task force ultimately published a report that made 14 recommendations to lower the cost of prescription drugs for Minnesotans, two of which are embodied in HF 17, summarized by Representative Stevenson. Alarmingly large price hikes are not limited to any particularly subset of drugs, but have a broad impact, from new brand-name drugs treating rare diseases to old, wide-spectrum generic antifungals. Thanks to recent price transparency initiatives and the Minnesota Department of Health's reporting, we're becoming more informed on manufacturers' pricing practices. For example, in 2017, the FDA approved the use of deflazacort for the treatment of a rare form of muscular dystrophy, including in children ages 5 and up. The FDA's approval is limited to a single manufacturer, who over the past 2 years has increased its wholesale acquisition cost, of deflazacort by over 30%. Resulting in increases anywhere from $1,500 to $3,250, depending on the dose of the drug. Fluconazole, an antifungal drug, was first commercially marketed in 1988. After the field of generic manufacturers making fluconazole narrowed, the remaining manufacturers engaged in rapid price inflation, increasing the wholesale acquisition cost of fluconazole over 1,000%, from around $2 to $28. Becoming informed is the first step in taking prudent action to safeguarding Minnesotans against hyperinflationary price hikes. Helping to prevent those price hikes' impact on Minnesotans is the next step. The Attorney General's office has an important role to play under HF 17, investigating excessive price increases, enforcing upper payment limits set by the Prescription Drug Affordability Board, and providing legal services to that board. HF 17 goes a long way to enacting the recommendation of Attorney General Ellison's Drug Pricing Task Force report, and would help Minnesotans afford their lives with dignity and respect by helping to lower the enormous costs that they bear when purchasing life-saving drugs. For these reasons, Attorney General Ellison strongly supports HF 17 and urges the committee to support its passage. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Llewellyn. Sharon Lamberton, followed by Judy Cook. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Lamberton. I'm with Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, 31 different biopharma companies in D.C. I'm a nurse by training, and we, too, agree that patients are having trouble affording their medications at the pharmacy counter. but we disagree that the Prescription Drug Affordability Board is the solution. I've included in your packets a list of solutions. I'm happy to talk through some of these five solutions if we have time. I also listed in our statement some concerns with legal implementation that states have faced that have PDABs that I'd like to bring your attention to. In February, Minnesota Department of Health issued their report that had clear limitations of data that the legislature wanted them to review and that they did receive from our companies. But the limitation of data is just not good for cost reviews. It said three things. One, the list price were used instead of net prices. The focus was only on manufacturers, not the entire supply chain. And third, reporting requirements treat drug pricing as if there's one functioning market under a single set of prices. And just to clarify, net prices only increased 1% in 2021. And I just encourage this committee to consider other policy solutions, delay the implementation of the PDAB until the Minnesota legislature has addressed the limitations in the Minnesota Department of Health's report. Finally, this bill does not guarantee savings at the pharmacy counter for patients, and there are other solutions. Thank you for your time, Chairwoman Liebling.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Judy Cook, followed by Bill Raker. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, representing the generic and biosimilar manufacturers. AAM is opposed to House File 17. This bill does not address the cost drivers in the prescription drug marketplace. The first sections of the bill only apply to lower cost generic drugs, not higher priced brand drugs. This is misplaced. Generic and biosimilar medicines save patients money with 91% of prescriptions filled, but only 18% of drug spending, and only 2% of total health care spending. Generic drugs are typically 70 to 80% lower cost than the brand. In the recently released MDH transparency report, of the 698 expected price increase reports, only 9 were for generic drugs. This bill allows the Attorney General and private individuals to sue a generic company when the wholesale acquisition cost, not the patient cost, increases by a dollar a day, regardless if that manufacturer's drug was even sold in Minnesota, but no action for a brand drug that is increased by thousands of dollars. Generic drugs have a competitive marketplace, are sold to wholesalers at a national level and usually outside of Minnesota. The WAC is not the price the wholesaler pays. That's negotiated and nearly always lower than the WAC. Once sold by the generic manufacturer, the wholesaler determines which generic manufacturer's products are distributed to Minnesota pharmacies. Further, in the bill, the entities downstream that increase the price to the patient cannot be sued. So regardless of where a price increase occurs, only the generic manufacturer is at risk because of this exemption. Nothing in the bill even requires that a Minnesota consumer actually paid an increased price at the pharmacy. There is also a provision prohibiting the withdrawal of a generic drug from the state without 90-day notice. But it's the wholesaler who sells the drug to pharmacies, so the generic manufacturer does not control if and when a product may be sold in Minnesota. It also appears the generic manufacturers have to report to the board and the Attorney General every time a generic drug is discontinued, which happens often. So far, none of the examples used to justify this bill would actually be covered. And this bill, it appears, only applies potentially only to those generic drug manufacturers located in Minnesota who operate in a global market.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
I am. Thank you. The focus on generic drugs in this bill is misplaced and provides false hope to Minnesotans that you are doing something to lower drug prices. We encourage you to oppose House File 17. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer anything.
Thank you for your testimony. Bill Raker. Welcome to the committee. If you would just give us your name, who you're with, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Bill Raker, and I am a volunteer with AARP Minnesota. On behalf of our nearly 620,000 members statewide, AARP appreciates this opportunity to testify in support of House File 17, which establishes a Drug Affordability Review Board and prohibits price gouging by drug manufacturers. We want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this important bill forward. Lowering the cost of prescription drugs is a high priority for AARP. High drug costs hurt everyone, not only those who rely on prescription drugs for their health, but all of us who are paying higher premiums and out-of-pocket costs, as well as the taxpayers who help fund our public programs. Americans have seen their prescription drug prices skyrocket, and they are sick and tired of paying the highest drug prices in the world for critically needed medication. About 30 years ago, the public was outraged over a drug that cost less than $10,000 per year, but now we face drug prices approaching $1 million per year. A recent study, July of last year, by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services noted the list prices of more than 1,200 prescription drugs rose faster than inflation, rising an average of 31.6%. AARP's 2021 Prescription Price Watch report found that in 2020, prices for 180 widely used specialty drugs increased more than 3.5 times faster than inflation. So it's hardly surprising that we hear stories from our members facing serious health and financial consequences due to high prescription drug prices. And the reality is that we are often talking about costs that patients will face every year for the rest of their lives. Under House File 17, the Affordability Board can review drug prices that pose an affordability challenge and set upper payment limits that apply throughout the healthcare system to protect consumers, state and local governments, providers, and all stakeholders.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Efforts like these will ensure that the consumers can access and afford the medications they need and could save tens of millions of dollars for patients, taxpayers, and our healthcare system. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing anybody. So I'm going to, and I just would like to point out to members that we do have a fiscal note in the packet. So that is all in order. And so now we have some amendments. And there's an A-10 amendment. Does someone want to offer the A-10? Representative Nadeau. Representative Nadeau is, well, you move it if you want to move it.
Go ahead. I'll move it.
All right.
Unless you wanted to. Thank you.
It is moved.
So thank you, Representative Stevenson. Good to see you again. It's been a bit since we've heard this bill in state and at state gov. And I just want to, you know, make sure that you recognize that I'm trying to do everything I can to help this bill. I know that you've been a little bit reticent to take some amendments, or at least during the committee hearings. Regardless of whether you do or not today, I just want to make sure that you know that I'm offering them in good faith. All of us here are against bad actors, wherever they are. All of us are here trying to reduce the cost of drugs to consumers. And so what the A-10 does is it's very simple. It delays the establishment of the Drug Affordability Board until January 1st of 2026, and then the board appointed by January 1st of 2024. And what we've heard and what I've learned is that there's concerns surrounding the medical research, new treatments, overall concerns with the significant negative impacts on patient health that the industry's pointed out. And we also know that this isn't simple. It's not just a drug manufacturer or a wholesaler or an insurer or a health plan or a pharmacist that controls the cost of these drugs. So. And my point here is we're about lowering the cost to patients. So Health File 17, it relies on the data submitted by the Prescription Drug Transparency Act to do the initial costs. And the problem that I'm having with that is that it focuses on list prices instead of net prices. All right, so that's the first thing. And then it's only, as I mentioned just previously, it's only focused on manufacturers. And then it only addresses the data limitations noted in the Department of Health in their report. So what my amendment does is it extends the implementation of this, and I think the biggest reason that we need to do this is that the upper payment in part of the, it's Section 14 of the bill, the current implementation date of the bill of 2024 occurs prior to the effective date of the Medicare maximum fair price. All right, so according to that timeline, and we're going to, you know, we're basically going to implement that where the feds have, you know, done the Inflation Reduction Act. We're going to basically adopt those things. And that's not going to be implemented until January 1st of 2026. So I'm hoping that by allowing us to extend this, it's going to give everyone in the industry more time. It's going to give more time for the board to establish itself, to determine which drugs it wants to evaluate, and give us more time to get everyone on board to ensure that at the end of the day that we're actually, there's a direct nexus between an upper payment limit and a consumer reduction in drug costs.
All right, Sheriff Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, I do appreciate, I assume that all amendments are offered in good faith. You know, I think that most members here are trying to do their best, and every once in a while I see one that is a little off kilter, but I don't view this one that, and so I absolutely think it's a good faith, and I just will politely say that I have taken amendments to this bill. I think you indicated that I had, and I have taken some amendments to this bill, including one from, I'm sure she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Representative Brindley offered it in the Commerce Committee on this bill related to the time for withdrawal from like 180 to 90 days. I don't know if it was, maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was someone else on the committee. Doesn't matter. The point is, I don't think that this is an amendment that is a good idea. You mentioned wanting more time for the industry. I guess my concern is that that's more time that Minnesotans are suffering under the high cost of prescription drugs. A lot of Minnesotans don't have time now. They're trying to make those difficult decisions I referenced right now. They need relief right now. And if there was a way to speed this up, I would do that. I'm not interested in saying up further, so I would ask for a no vote, respectfully.
All right. Representative Nadeau, you have something further? Because usually I would give the last
yes,
word.
Yes, I just
to
want to add one,
bill.
You know, one more thing to this. And I wish we could do it faster too. I mean, if we could actually, you know, there's been seven states that have done this. None of them have actually gotten to the point where we've reduced the cost, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. There's only three of those seven that actually have that allowed a board to set an upper payment limit. So this is not a simple matter. It shouldn't be moved into quickly. I understand that what we're trying to get to, but just because what we want to try to do and what actually can occur, I just don't think is here. So I get it that you don't support that one. Thank you for considering it.
All right. So all in favor of the A10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. No. Motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. To the other amendments in the packet, Representative Nadeau, are they yours as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Did you want to move one of them?
I will take the – let's do the A11.
All right, so Representative Nadeau is moving the A11 to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A11. This amendment should be kind of interesting, I hope. It allows the Prescription Drug Affordability Board to recommend an upper payment limit for prescription drug instead of setting that limit. The recommendation of the board would then need approval by the Minnesota legislature to become effective. And I mentioned earlier that the challenge that other states have had in implementing this, and once again, this bill focuses on price controls. And I think we should be focusing on increasing price transparency, and I think this amendment does that. In Maryland, the law includes similar language to what's being here from the legislature or the governor, the attorney general, you know, in order to set that upper payment limit. And to date, that authority has not been granted. This amendment doesn't prohibit setting that upper payment limit, but requires the additional step in reviewing the upper payment limit before it's established. You pointed out earlier that a good example of this would be the PUC. I would submit that unelected bodies are never a good idea to set price controls. I think that it should come back to the legislature. I believe that there's some unanticipated, unintended consequences because of this. Again, this bill relies on the data collected under the Prescription Drug Transparency Act. And just late in February, we saw that released some data, and I think it's good. But we don't even know yet if that actually is going to solve the problem that maybe we're trying to solve without having to do this. Once again, it's focused on list prices, not net prices. And so I would suggest that this might be a good idea so that the legislature can then take the recommendations and then set the upper payment limit affecting consumer prices.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, appreciate the thought here, but I'm going to ask for a no vote on this amendment. I think that adding another step where we'd have to then come back to the legislature and do this legislatively would needlessly delay things. And, we have an unfortunate habit in the legislature of getting bogged down in gridlock from time to time, and I don't think that people should have to wait for our partisan battles to be resolved before they see relief in their drug prices. So I would ask for a no vote.
All right. Thank you. So all in favor of the
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Okay. Representative Doe, I do generally give the chair, the person who's presenting the bill, the last word on the amendment. So, I'm sorry. Was it someone else? All right. I thought you wanted to talk again. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. You know, the one thing that we do poorly is we don't watch government overreach. And when you look at the Attorney General and these special groups that could really dictate how these businesses, whether they stay in business or not, whether they're winners or losers, and we have a poor track record right now of that happening. Dr. Scott Jensen right now, he's in a little trouble. So we don't want overreach. So certainly the amendment that Representative Nero brought up is certainly applicable. So I appreciate you taking a closer look at it. But thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I guess I just would say if there are any winners right now, big, big winners, it's the drug industry. Oh, my gosh. And the losers are the Minnesotans who are trying to get the drugs sometimes to literally stay alive. But I just would add, too, that those who've been around for a while, maybe the legislature is sometimes the right place to make decisions and often not the right place to make decisions, kind of what Chair Stevenson was talking about. But also, when issues come to the legislature, by their very nature, they are political issues. That's just, we are a political body, and there are some decisions that I think it makes sense to try to insulate from political direct influence. Of course, I guess I would argue that nothing ever really is, but to the degree that we can, I just think that it's kind of not a bad thought, not a bad idea, but I don't think bringing this back to the legislature is really workable. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just point out that it does make sense to bring it back to the legislature and to suggest that the board will not be political. The makeup of the board in the language is 100% partisan. It's made up entirely by appointees from the governor and the Speaker of the House and the majority leader, and the implementation date is such that it will be a 100% partisan board without any dissenting views. So, I mean, if our argument is to take politics out of it, that's not going to solve the problem. It's a good amendment. Thank you, Representative Nadeau.
All right. Representative Murphy, and then we're going to vote.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing that I think is important, you talked about just the overreach of drug companies, but this actually is just going to work on one part of them. It's only for the generics. And so it could actually hurt the generics' chances to stay in business, to offer a competitive price, and so we might have a completely different marketplace, too. So because the other manufacturers are not included, I think it's really focusing on generics.
Final word, Chair Stevenson.
I just want to correct I think was just a misconception from Representative Murphy. The first half of the bill only relies to generics. The second half of the bill does not pertain, and that's the provision that's being modified by Representative Nadeau's amendment. So the discussion here actually pertains to all drugs, not just generics.
All right. With that, all in favor of the A11 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Motion prevails. Does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. Okay. To the A12?
That's mine. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A12 is very similar to the A11. Except what this does is it basically makes a recommendation for an upper payment limit for prescription drug that payers could then choose to use and the Minnesota legislature could evaluate instead of setting an upper payment limit. You know, Representative New Brindley is right. I mean, this will be a political board. And it's bad enough, in my opinion, when government decides drug prices. The only thing worse than that is when a partisan government board would set those prices. You know, on average, you know, we forget that it takes 10 years and about $2.5 billion to develop new drugs. Price controls at an upper payment limit may impede, you know, what comes to market. The R&D investment, and I know that there was a testifier up here that said the public invests in this. Well, they do, but at a very low level. And there might be a role for an advisory body to make recommendations, you know, for the legislature. But it should encapsulate the cost of drugs and include medications, include insurers, include PBMs, wholesalers, government. And this bill, you know, this bill is so focused on trying to create a cap and control prices that it's ignoring, you know, all those things that and it's ignoring all those things that are involved in setting a price. There's always negative consequences when government sets prices. I mean, price controls lead to shortages. They lower quality, less innovation, fewer new products and options. Just look at, you know, St. Paul's rent control. The feds have already enacted drug price, you know, controls with the adoption of the Inflation Reduction Act. And I'm going to stop because I know where this amendment's going to go. I do hope, Representative Stevenson, and I know you will, you're going to continue to focus on and maybe be able to have a little more discussion, you know, when we talk about the bill. But I know that you are doing everything in your power to drive down those costs. I am very fearful that what this bill does is there's no nexus between setting an upper payment limit and the actual cost to a consumer. I've tried to amend so that we could take time to identify that. So hopefully in your closing, you can establish that sequence for me. And with that, I'm going to withdraw this amendment, Madam Chair, because I don't think my friends are going to vote with me on it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Doe.
Not enough of my
we are, I was going to say, we are your friends, and thank you very much for that. So the A12 is withdrawn. And with that discussion to the bill, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And two questions, first to the process and then to the bill. This, I'm assuming, could be carried in the Commerce Omnibus Bill and the Health Omnibus Bill. Do you have any idea on how that's going to play out or split up?
Chair Stevenson, did you want to address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, I do intend to suggest to my committee that this should be included in the Commerce Omnibus.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. The one question that I'll ask on this today is, I was for the life of me looking through this bill and trying to figure out what impact or requirements that Medicaid will have to this and what they're paying. Can you help me find that and maybe explain what the impact is going to be, if there is one?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, I'm not sure I'm entirely tracking your question. You know, of course, we can't control Medicare at the state level. There is the intersection in terms of the what's happened in the Inflation Reduction Act and how that relates to the setting of an upper payment limit that's in the bill. And I could direct you to where that is in the bill if that's what you're talking about. But if you had something else in mind, maybe you could be more specific in your question. I'm sorry.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson. I found the Medicare parts. It's Medicaid and what we'll be paying for drugs through that, through the state.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher, I'm sorry, you said Medicaid, and I thought you said Medicare. That's my mistake.
Confusion, yeah.
I think when you look at the implementation sections of the upper payment limit, we talk about who this particularly applies to. So I would suggest that you look in particular at Subdivision 2 of Section 14, which talks about the implementation and administration of the upper payment limit.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson. So from that, I can assume that Medicaid will be paying at the upper payment limit for the drugs that we're paying for Minnesotans.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, again, I would direct you in particular to where to Subdivision 2 of Section 14, where it discusses how the upper payment limit affects all of the various payers in the state.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to wrap up with that, I do think that there will be an impact to this, and I'll continue looking for it in there with Medicaid rates and what our Medicaid reimbursements and what they'll have to pay. I see that the fiscal note was silent. I look for it in that too. Here and what that's going to be, and we'll hopefully be able to find some kind of answer as this continues to move along as to what impact this is going to have to our Medicaid spending in the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Schumacher, I wonder if we have anybody here from the department who could maybe speak to that. Mr. Hope is coming down. Welcome to the committee. Have you got the question so you can go ahead and answer it?
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Chad Hope. I'm the Director of Pharmacy and Medicaid Decision Support at DHS. I think I understand the question. It was, what would the impact be to Medicaid if we were subject to an upper payment limit? Operationally, we use what's called a maximum allowable cost today, which is setting a cap at what we reimburse drugs for. If there was to be a cap established and we were subject to it, we could operationalize that by utilizing it as our cap. I do not know whether or not it would be equivalent, higher, or lower than our current maximum allowable cost, though, so I can't theorize on that.
Thank you, Representative. And Mr. Hope, so what I'm understanding here then would be that you can't really, there's no cost in the fiscal note for that, because if the upper payment level is higher than what you're currently paying, that wouldn't make you pay that upper payment limit. You don't have to raise your payment. And you're saying that you wouldn't necessarily be subject to that cap, or that the cap wouldn't affect the Medicaid program if you were hitting it. Did I get that correctly?
Madam Chair, I believe I followed the first part. It's correct. If the cap was higher than our maximum allowable rate, we would be able to continue to use that rate. If the rate was lower, in theory, you could hypothesize that there would be a savings. I would say that we've operationalized a pretty fair and aggressive maximum allowable cost because of federal requirements that say we have to pay the actual acquisition cost. So what the outcome would be, I don't know, but we could operationalize it.
Okay. So that sounds to me, putting it another way, and please correct me if I'm this is really complicated. Whoever said that in this hearing, numerous people have said it. This all is very complicated stuff. But if you were to, for some reason, hit the cap, it would be a savings. If you were, you'd have to pay less. It would be a savings to the state. But that wouldn't happen, is I think what I hear you saying, because you wouldn't be, because you're already having savings from paying lower prices.
Madam Chair, I would hope we're paying a very efficient rate right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the impact would be.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if Judy Cook would stand for a question. So, Ms. Cook, you actually hit on something that I had on my list of questions. And as I was looking at Section 5, subdivision 2 at the end of page 4, beginning of page 5. I'm wondering, the question that I had, you said that I think you said something along the lines of drugs might come off the market or leave a state often. And I had the question on my list, how many drugs might come off the market each year? What is the burden on a manufacturer here? And tangential to that or related to that is, how does a manufacturer, how does a manufacturer interact with the states right now? And how would that all go together?
Ms. Cook?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley. So my understanding of this provision, which I think is consistent with what you find in the fiscal note, is that regardless of price increases or price decreases, every time a generic manufacturer discontinues manufacturing a drug, arguably they would have to report to the Board of Pharmacy and the Attorney General, because they have no way of knowing if the wholesalers are actually going to sell their drug into Minnesota. And so generic manufacturers, by their nature, manufacture different drugs at different times. So I can't really put a number on it, but it could happen frequently. I mean, furthermore, because of the offshore competition, we are seeing generic drug companies, they're closing, they're being bought out by each other. And so there are a lot of changes in the generic drug market that would result in reports to the Board of Pharmacy and the Attorney General. And what's troubling about this is, in the fiscal note, you'll note that the Board of Pharmacy says they will set up a repository for it, but there is literally nothing that is done with this information. So it is just a cost driver for generic manufacturers, of which we have a number in Minnesota, and so that's the concern. Now, can you remind me of your second question? I got carried away with the first.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, something you just said, I will augment my other question based on what you just said. You said that the manufacturers have no way of knowing if a drug is sold in their state.
In Minnesota, correct.
I assume that's any state, doesn't not just Minnesota. Yeah. The language in the bill only applies to transactions in Minnesota. I'm trying to understand the interaction between manufacturers and the state. And you're saying that the manufacturers have no way of knowing if a drug is sold in a state? How is that all going to play out together?
Ms. Carr.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley. So generic drug companies sell to what are really three, there are three primary wholesalers. And the generic companies are located all across the country. Again, there are a handful who are based in Minnesota and manufacture here. And so they sell, and what happens is a wholesaler says to a generic company, I want this, 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 and this drug. And the generic company comes with, I can make these drugs and sell them to you at this price. Again, usually much lower than the WAC price, which is what what the bill deals with. And so then it's the wholesaler who then sends it to their various distribution centers, and it may go into Minnesota, it may not. So when you go to the pharmacy, sometimes if you get a generic, it might look different than the last time you got it because it's a different manufacturer, because the wholesalers are looking for the best price. It's a competitive marketplace. So at any given time, a generic manufacturer literally does not know which states their drug is sold in. They've sold it to a wholesaler, probably outside of Minnesota. The wholesaler sells it to the pharmacy. That distribution center could be outside of Minnesota. And that's how generic drugs make it to our pharmacy for Minnesota consumers.
All right. Thank you. Final question, Representative New Brindley, and then we are going to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my last question then would be for Representative Stevenson. And I apologize, Chair Stevenson. In this moment, I don't have the time to scan the bill in my notes. Apparently there's three primary wholesalers, but clearly manufacturers work with wholesalers. Does this bill address that relationship? It looks like the onus here, the notice must be given by a manufacturer, but it sounds like the manufacturer is not necessarily the one determining whether a drug is sold into a state or not. Does the bill address the wholesalers then on that front as well?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, Section 5 pertains only to the manufacturer. It's meant to cure the problem of if we have a situation where a generic drug company is being is price gouging, that they can't cure by just denying people access to the drugs and saying we're not going to allow our drugs to be sold into the Minnesota marketplace. And, you know, this is, as we keep saying, a complex problem. And I don't think that I've ever represented that this is the whole solution. In fact, I've often said that this is just one piece of the puzzle. So I totally understand that there are other movers and players in the system and other pressure points that we should be looking at. I know there's a lot of bills looking at a lot of different avenues, from, you know, some of the things that Representative Elkins is doing on transparency to some of the things that Representative Howard is doing on copays. I mean, there's a lot of different places that we can be looking at this. But this particular provision that you're referencing to only applies to the manufacturer.
All right. I'm going to call on Representative Quam, who was accidentally knocked off the list previously, and then we're going to lay the bill over. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on this bill and other bills we're going to be hearing, the big winners are those that are alive and their loved ones that still have them. And so while we're pursuing the bad actors, we need to make sure that we don't cause damage to the wonder of modern medicine and future medicine in the process, because the only thing worse than not, you know, having an expensive medicine is not having any medicine and no hope. Early on, the author stated and used monopolistic. By definition, generic drugs are meant to add a more cost-effective source of medications and competition. So it's by definition anti-monopolistic. Frankly, we haven't talked about the issue. In the past 2 years, we've had a shortage of drugs, whether they've been antibiotics and stuff for children or drugs for adults. We've had shortages. And going to a pharmacy and not being able to get the drug, or being told we can give you a 1 or 2 days dosage, you know, that's something we have to be concerned about. Minnesota is not an island. And when we set these systems up to catch bad actors, we need to avoid causing unintended consequences of a shortage of medications in our pharmacies. And so good intentions require looking down every now and then so we don't step in it on the path to what we're after. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. So with that, House File 17, the third engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. All right, we are going to take up, and we are going to 1230 today, members. House File 2275, Representative Ryer. So Representative Ryer is going to move that House File 2275 be laid over for possible inclusion. And this is, Representative Ryer, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 2275 is one of the agency bills. It covers four different areas, and in the interest of efficiency, I am going to ask Ms. Christy Grom to take us through the bill.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. So the four, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for helping us out with this important policy bill. So the four main areas that this bill is changing are major substantive changes, but I'll walk through them. So the first one is related to general assistance, housing support, Minnesota supplemental aid, and just making sure that we're aligning the application requirements for those cash assistance programs with our family cash assistance programs, so MFIP and DWP. The second change is just clarifying the definition of supportive housing, and then also clarifying that multi-tribal collaboratives are eligible for the community living infrastructure grant. The third provision is codifying several mental health, adult mental health grants that are current grants and just not specified in statute. And this is related to a direction from the 2021 legislature. And then lastly, this bill is just relocating a medical assistance room and board rate provision to the MA eligibility section. It currently is in the housing support statute. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to walk through kind of section by section or just stand for questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Grauman. Just one quick question for me. This has no cost, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. This has went through our rigorous MMB policy bill process that we do at the department, and it does not have a cost.
All right. Thank you very much. So, okay. So, are there any questions for members? Or I should say, is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. I don't see anyone. Questions from members. So this is essentially a technical bill, I would characterize it, correct?
Madam Chair, right. I think that's an accurate characterization.
All right, thank you. All right, so I'm not seeing any member questions. So with that, House File 2275 is laid over for possible inclusion. And its possibilities are really good. So, okay. So now we are to the sort of the main event here. So I'm going to move House File 2050 to be placed on the general register. And there is a DE1 amendment, and I'm just going to stay here, members, and even though this is my bill, but what we're doing here today now is assembling what we like to call a minibus, a mini omnibus bill, out of bills that we have heard before. So those of you who haven't been here before and seen this process, you'll see it again this session. This is how we kind of, for efficiency, we're putting together a lot of policy bills, most of which I hope are reasonably non-controversial. So, and that, of course, will not always be the case for our bills. But so I'm going to move the DE1 amendment, which is in your packets, to get this before the committee. And so what the DE1 is a compilation of other bills that we heard and laid over. These are the policy bills from MDH. And I think we probably have a summary here in the packet. We don't. Okay. I guess, should we, let's see, Ms. Clarkfist, can you just kind of quickly, if you have the list, can you kind of quickly run through what's in the DE1, just so members are aware, because it is a lot to ask them to just read through it.
So, Madam Chair and members, the DE1 amendment contains the following bills that were heard last Wednesday in this committee, and they include amendments that were adopted last Wednesday, and then in two cases there were additional amendments that I'll note. So they include House File 1329, which is the cancer reporting system language, with the author's A1 amendment. House File 1356, which is Representative Jordan's lead service lines bill, with the A1 amendment. House File 1447, which made changes to the Lead Poisoning Prevention Act, with the author's A1 amendment. House File 1465, which made changes to administration of naloxone in schools, with the author's A1 amendment. House File 1491, which makes changes to the membership of the Rural Health Advisory Committee. House File 1679, which modifies what's used in plan reviews for hospital physical plant requirements, with the author's A1 amendment and with an additional technical amendment from the Health Department that was developed in consultation with the Hospitals Association related to effective dates, to make the effective dates work better for the hospitals. House File 2038, which is the bill related to over-the-counter hearing aids. It includes both the author's A1 amendment and the A2-1 amendment from last week. And it also includes an additional amendment that the health department developed with some other interested parties related to hearing aid dispensers and audiologists being able to sell over-the-counter hearing aids, that they'll still be able to perform that function. House File 2050, which is related to fetal death records with the A1 amendment. House File 2052, home care surveys with the A2-1 amendment. House File 2231, nursing home change of ownership. And House File 2232 with the author's A1 amendment.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Barkfist. And then, okay, and then before we adopt the DE1 amendment, I would like to move a couple of amendments to the amendment. So we have, I would move the A2 amendment to put the DE in its intended form, and this is the bill that Representative Schumacher is carrying that we just had an informational hearing on it. So we're just adding it. So we're just building our minibus here. So everyone understands what the A2 is then. So all in favor of adoption of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A2 is adopted. And then we have the A3 amendment, which is a little bit bigger. And this is the bill that we just heard. Correct? This is Representative Ryer's bill that we just heard and laid over, that I made the comment that it was, you know, very likely to be included. Here it is as an amendment. So any questions about that? All right. All in favor of adoption of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A3 is amended. So now we have in front of us the DE1 as amended, which is all of these bills that we heard and laid over, and essentially this is our agency policy bill. I need to move the DE1 again as amended. To put it into the House File 2050. So all in favor of the DE1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And so now what we have before us, members, is House File 2050 as amended, which has magically been transformed into a policy omnibus bill. So is there any discussion to the House File 2050 as amended? Representative Nadeau.
I'm just curious, what are we repealing? We're repealing 144.9505 subdivision 3.
In what line are you on, Representative Nadeau?
50.15 of the original DE1.
Okay, Ms. Clarkvist, can you respond to that?
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, that repealer is a direction to the Commissioner of Health to provide certain information related to lead abatement activities to construction employees, and I believe that's being repealed because that is now addressed in federal rules instead. But the health department can correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Representative Nadeau, would you like the health department to come down and address it?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks. No, I appreciate that you're asking. I think it's, you know, we need to try. There's a lot of information that flows through here, and as best we can, it's great if we understand what it all is. And so other questions or discussion? All right, seeing none, and I just would, again, thank all the members who carried bills that are in here, and again, when this comes to the floor, although I'm the nominal author of it, I hope each of you who has a bill in here would be prepared to answer questions. And also, it is, as always, if you're, you know, you have a concern, let me know, okay, so that we can move this expeditiously. So all in favor, so again, I would renew my motion that House File 2050 as amended be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails and the bill is going to the general register. Okay, the last bill on the agenda is House File 1790, which is mine, so I'm going to ask Representative Bierman to take the gavel.
Welcome to the committee, Madam Chair. Would you like to move House File 1790?
I would. Thank you. I would move that House File 1790 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I do have, I think there is a technical amendment that I would like to move to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to have it discussed. So I would move the A1 amendment.
All right. The A1 is moved. And would you like to describe that A1?
Right. It's a technical amendment. That was
okay.
Given to me by House Research.
Very good.
In the Commerce Committee.
All right. So, all in favor of the A1?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? And the bill is, the amendment is accepted, and we are ready for you to present the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, this is a bill that I just would let you know up front is going to be possibly carried in the Commerce Omnibus Bill. You know, Commerce and our committee have kind of dual jurisdiction over health insurance. This is a bill that is, it's really about health insurance. So we usually don't think of doing anything in this legislature that impacts Medicare, the federal program mostly for older people. And so over the years, I have really not learned all that much about Medicare. But this is one area of Medicare-related policies that the state does have jurisdiction over, and that is what are called Medigap policies. So people who buy original, who have original Medicare, who do not buy a what's called a Medicare Advantage program. This is staying with original Medicare, and then they buy usually they buy a drug plan, and then often they buy what's known as a Medigap plan, and this covers the out-of-pockets because although Medicare covers, I think it's 80% of costs, there are a certain, the other 20% are borne by the person who is covered, and there is no upper limit. So when you hear sometimes from your constituents about struggling to afford costs under Medicare, this is what they often are talking about, their out-of-pocket costs. So there are these Medigap insurance policies, which, as it turns out, are regulated by the state. And it turns out that under our regulation, we are not really doing so well for consumers. As you might really think, oh, Minnesota, you know, we really try to be very consumer friendly and we're trying to help our folks who are, you know, elderly, struggling with costs and so on. But this is one area where we really haven't been. So in Minnesota right now, oh, let me back up again a little bit and just say, under the Affordable Care Act, most of us have become accustomed to the idea that there isn't any medical underwriting for when you want to buy a policy. In other words, if you go on MnSure and you want to buy an insurance policy, they don't say, well, have you had heart disease? And if you say yes, then they say, well, you're going to have to pay more or maybe we won't sell you a policy. We don't do that anymore. The Affordable Care Act took all of that away. In this Medigap world, though, that is still a thing. And that is what we need to change because a lot of states don't do that. Minnesota is still doing that. So right now in Minnesota, during the first 6 months a person is eligible to sign up for Medicare, there is an open enrollment period for Medigap plans. During that first 6 months, the insurer cannot use underwriting or deny the issuance of the plan. Although they can say that if you've been treated for any illness or diagnosed within 90 days, they can then exclude coverage for that disease for the first 6 months, I think it is. So even that is limited. They can, you know, kind of deny some of the coverage if you've had medical issues. And then after that six-month period in Minnesota, insurers can actually refuse to sell you a policy if you have medical concerns, if you've had a pre-existing condition, or they can charge you more for your insurance. So kind of back to the bad old days. So what the bill does is it removes the underwriting. It puts this on the same level with other insurance in Minnesota, which is kind of the expectation that people have. It also establishes an annual open enrollment period in addition to the special enrollment periods like the one I just mentioned when a person first goes on Medicare. And so that is that open enrollment lines up with the other open enrollment for Medicare. So that it will be very much in line with expectations. So since this is really this is the health committee and not the insurance committee, which is the commerce committee, I don't know that, you know, how much more we need to really go into this, but I did just want to make this committee aware of it because it's a really important issue for our constituents, and a lot of states do not do it the way we do. I think it's about 8 states, if I'm not mistaken, are already have absolutely no restriction, and then others have less restriction on consumers than we do here in Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think that's really all I need to say. I think there was a testifier possibly.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lee Bling. We have 2 testifiers listed. First up, Mr. Dana Bacon. Please state your name for the committee.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Bierman and members. I'm Dana Bacon. I'm Senior Director of State Government Affairs for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, here to speak in support of today's bill. I mean, as we've heard discussed, aging Americans usually enroll in some type of Medicare program when they reach age 65. And as we know, there's no out-of-pocket spending limit for Parts A and B. To reduce those costs, people often buy Medigap plans. These are important products for people who have blood cancer. Cancer treatment is notoriously expensive. Patients could face tens of thousands of dollars a year in out-of-pocket costs if they don't have some type of supplemental Medigap coverage to help protect them. Chair Liebling's discussed problems with medical underwriting after the initial enrollment window closes. We don't like to see seniors with pre-existing conditions put in a bind, especially, you know, those conditions can arise after you enroll in Medicare or Medicare Advantage. And we don't want to see plans deny people coverage. We don't want to see them raise their premiums based on a medical history that they had no choice in. And we like the fact that House File 1790 keeps plans from discriminating based on medical history. We think patients will have better coverage options and providers will face less bad debt if this bill moves forward, which we think is good news for blood cancer patients. So thank you, Chair Liebling, for bringing this bill forward. Hope you support this bill. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bacon, for your testimony. We have a second testifier listed, Dave Garibaldi. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Garibaldi. Pre-existing condition restrictions are one of the most cruel and harmful legacies of our for-profit healthcare system. By their very design, they present an opportunity for insurers to maximize profits at the expense of enrollees' health. Overall, I support the removal of these restrictions on moral grounds. However, the existence of Medicare Advantage plans as an alternative to traditional Medicare presents a conundrum. Medicare Advantage plans are heavily subsidized by CMS, and that subsidy is around $1,000 per month per enrollee. Hence, these large subsidies enable private insurers to offer lower premiums, which attract seniors, especially those with lower incomes. The privatizing of Medicare through the Medicare Advantage program is threatening Medicare itself. Soon, enrollment in Medicare Advantage will constitute more than half of all Medicare enrollees. Perhaps this wouldn't be a problem if Medicare Advantage had lived up to the cost savings and quality improving goals it was intended to achieve. But the facts have shown just the opposite. Last fall, an expose in the New York Times revealed widespread fraud by many companies participating in the Medicare Advantage program. The reporters described how major health insurers exploited the Medicare Advantage program to increase their profits by billions of dollars. Companies use upcoding or adding inappropriate diagnosis codes to patient files, which make patients appear sicker, thus allowing higher subsidies from CMS. So instead of saving money, Medicare Advantage costs taxpayers a lot more than traditional Medicare. One former government official estimates that overpayments in 2020 alone totaled $25 billion. Ironically, traditional Medicare enrollee premiums must pay for this abuse, hence the conundrum. Equally disturbing, as described in June by Kaiser Health News, these companies also commonly increase their profits by delaying or denying care or actually lemon-dropping expensive patients.
Mr. Garibaldi, we'll have to have you wrap up.
By eliminating their doctor or hospital from the plan's network. Many of these patients return to traditional Medicare, where under current law in Minnesota, they can be denied coverage or forced to pay more costly premiums for their supplemental plan. No one should have to deal with these barriers to care, especially when they are very sick. Please support HF 1790. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garibaldi, for the testimony. Anyone else from the public wish to testify? Seeing none, we can move to member questions and discussions. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this working? I don't think so. Is this better? No, they're both. Neither. I'll just speak up. Okay. My wife and I became Medicare eligible about 5 years ago. And those of you who know me would not be surprised to learn that when I was evaluating the options, it involved a very complicated spreadsheet. among the options are just plain old Medicare. Plain old Medicare with a Medigap plan and Medicare Advantage. And what my analysis revealed is that anyone that had or was at risk of having an expensive chronic condition, it would make more sense to sign up for a Medigap plan. The premiums are actually much higher than they are on Medicare Advantage. But after, you know, doing that kind of risk-reward analysis, looking at what was available in the in both the Medigap market and the Medicare Advantage market, we opted to go with a Medicare Advantage plan and have been happy with the choices. So at the time, as the chair, Chair Lievely mentioned under her introduction, when you first enroll in Medicare, you have the option of going into a Medigap plan if it makes the most sense for you without underwriting. But once you have made the choice to go down a different path and choose Medicare Advantage as an alternative, for example, you can't then switch back, to a Medigap plan if your circumstances change. And that's the essence of what we're trying to do with this bill. But if you have the option to wait until you have leukemia or whatever, an expensive chronic condition to make this change, and you can make the change back to Medigap without any underwriting, you really do create an adverse selection problem. Because you can take advantage, as we are, of the lower Medicare Advantage premiums. My wife and I this year are actually on a plan that has no premium other than our Part B, Medicare Part B required payment. And we've been actually very happy with the service. But I went into that eyes open understanding that as soon as we went down that path, we would lose the ability to switch to a Medicap plan without going through underwriting. So you make that choice eyes wide open. And I would really be concerned about creating an adverse selection problem for underwriters of Medigap plans if you could wait until you get really sick to go to make that switch back.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins answered and made my point, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. A final word, Representative Liebling?
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, adverse selection, that's why we have open enrollment periods. Mm-hmm. And you could say the same thing about, under the ACA.
Yep.
And I know there are things on the back end to adjust, but this is also about having some competition in the market as well, allowing people to actually change plans so that the plans have to compete. So that's another way to, in fact, reduce costs. So, I guess, let's just face it, insurance, let me just be very plain, health insurance as a whole system, as a way of financing and delivering health care, it's full of flaws, terrible flaws. It really sucks. I just, the media can quote me, health insurance as a system sucks. And this is just an example of that. It really illustrates it, but we are really putting a lot of our folks in Minnesota at a terrible disadvantage, a Medicare disadvantage. And I appreciate the testifier talking a little bit about Medicare Advantage. Unfortunately, that's beyond our purview here in the legislature. But this Medigap thing is not. And so thank you for hearing the bill, and I would appreciate it to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. The bill, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over, and we are adjourned.